Let's set the scene. On November 8, 2016, American voters went to the polls to elect the next president of the United States. The magic number for the Democratic and Republican presidential candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, was 270, the number of votes needed to secure a majority of the Electoral College, and with it, victory. When the sun rose on November 9th, there was a clear winner.
It is my high honor and distinct privilege to introduce to you the President-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
Like us, you probably paid close attention to the 2016 U.S. presidential race as it unfolded over the past year. With a victory now decided, you might be wondering, what next? Inauguration Day is just 10 weeks away. What are President-elect Trump's next steps? I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And I'm Robert McMahon, Managing Editor of CFR.org.
And you're listening to The President's Inbox, a new Council on Foreign Relations podcast that examines the challenges that President-elect Donald Trump will face when he takes the oath of office on January 20th, 2017. Over the next 10 weeks, we're going to examine the issues that he will find at the top of his inbox when he arrives in the Oval Office. We're going to discuss what he has said he will do, what his priorities might be, and what challenges he could likely confront. Here are his two most immediate priorities: assembling a new administration and deciding how to start his presidency.
I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans, and this is so important to me. For those who have chosen not to support me in the past, of which there were a few people, I'm reaching out to you for your guidance and your help so that we can work together and unify our great country.
Over the next several weeks, President-elect Trump will be announcing his picks for cabinet posts, major White House positions, and thousands of other positions across the executive branch. He will also be mapping out how he wants his team to interact and which policies and plans he will implement when he first gets into office. That team and what it decides to do first will go a long way in deciding whether the Trump presidency gets off to a strong or shaky start.
With us this week to help examine these priorities is Elizabeth Saunders, a visiting fellow here at the Council on Foreign Relations and a political science professor at George Washington University. Elizabeth, thanks for being here.
Thanks, my pleasure.
Well, let's get down to business. For the uninitiated, what are the distinctive features, would you say, of the U.S. transitional process here between presidential administrations?
Well, Bob, many who live abroad and live in democracies can't believe that our elections take so long, right? That we have this election season that's dragged on now for what it feels like forever, but has been, you know, about more than a year. Many countries have three-week election periods. Transition is very similar. Our transition goes from Election Day until January 20th, and that's a fairly good, you know, couple months. In many other countries, for example, parliamentary democracies, it goes like that. It's very quick. You may remember in the political chaos that surrounded the Brexit vote, very shortly thereafter, British Prime Minister David Cameron, then Prime Minister, resigned. But that was a moment of his choosing. He chose to resign. He also, when he resigned, stated at his own choosing the hour that he would move out of 10 Downing Street, and that allowed his party some time to get its act together and choose a new leader, which was a very orderly process. And then a moving van came up to Downing Street, and out he moved with his family, and in moved Theresa May.
It seemed blindingly fast.
To us, it seems blindingly fast, but ours seems like a very slow-moving train, I'm sure, to many around the world. So this will be both a drawn-out process, and it will also in some ways be lightning fast because, as I'm sure we'll discuss very shortly, there is a very, very large stack of things in the president's inbox, and he needs people to help him sort that out.
Right. I mean, when you look at the presidential transition in the United States, what's remarkable compared to other countries is how many positions have to be replaced. The Trump team is going to decide over the next several weeks how to fill something on the order of 4,000 positions across the executive branch. About 1,000 of those will require Senate confirmation. The newspaper is going to talk a lot about some of the most visible positions.
So these are not discretionary. These have to be filled.
These have to be filled. You're talking your cabinet, your 15 executive agencies. You're talking about filling slots that aren't don't require Senate confirmation, like who's going to staff your White House, chief of staff,
national security advisor,
legislative liaison, all just dozens of positions. And just positions across the executive branch have to be filled because, again, in the American system, it's like when you have the inauguration day, it's a whole group goes out and a whole new group has to come in. And it can take a while, actually, to fill all of those positions, particularly when you think of the ones that require Senate confirmation because the Senate has to act on them. And the Senate obviously will move very quickly on cabinet-level positions, Secretary of State, Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of Defense. But there are a lot of lower-level assistant secretaries, deputy assistant secretaries.
And that's really where foreign policy gets made on a day-to-day level, right? Oh. I mean, you know, we see in the newspapers all the top-level people, but it's really those people at the layers just below that actually make policy on a day-to-day level. So those are very, very important. Do you think it'll move more quickly because Trump will have a Republican Congress behind him more quickly than usual?
Well, presumably it will because you're going to have a Republican Senate. And so you would expect the Republican Senate to want to move quickly on Republican president's nominees. But again, even when the Senate moves quickly, there are so many laws about disclosure, forms you have to fill out for ethics rules and like that takes time. You have to schedule hearings. And I think what you'll see is cabinet level positions, the secretary of, those slots will get filled quickly. But it will still take a while for the committees and the Senate as a whole to get through the long list of places they have to confirm.
So this will go on well past January 20th then?
Oh, yeah. I would not be surprised to see the Senate still moving on nominations in March, April, May. I mean, that would be fairly standard. I mean, if you look across most administrations, about on average, about 80% of the slots they have to fill are filled, which means about 20% are unfilled at any given time. So really, let's take time to staff up an administration.
So meanwhile, backing up, though, prior to Election Day, there's this fairly long-time process, I believe, of the lead candidates setting up transition teams. So a couple of months ahead of Election Day, they're doing this. There was a lot of attention this year to the fact that Trump was taking part in these intelligence briefings, that he wasn't necessarily finding agreement with some of the things he was hearing, mm-hmm. or that at least that issue was raised. But be that as it may, that's an indication of there is a few months ahead of time this exposure to these issues that is seen as necessary to so they can hit the ground, maybe not running, right, but at least walking briskly.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is that this process you talked about is sort of beginning planning for transition starting in really about the summer is relatively new. There was a law passed in 1963 setting out a way which transition should be handled. But for a long time, there was sort of a sense of it was presumptuous if you started planning for a transition before you were actually elected. And I think it became clear to people that that wasn't a very good way to approach the issue because of the enormity of the task. You have so many slots to fill. While 10 weeks seems long in a parliamentary system, in our system, 10 weeks is a very short period of time because you have to do a couple of things. You have to vet people, decide who is it you want to have on your team. You have to figure out how you want to run your White House and what we call the interagency process, all those things that be decided before noontime on January 20th. And then you have to figure out what policies you're going to want to follow. I mean, you said a lot of things on the campaign trail, but campaigning is one thing, governing is an entirely different thing, and you have to figure all that out so you can hit the ground running. So back in 2010, a law was passed which actually provided fairly substantial federal government spending to create a formal transition team. First went into effect back in 2012. We've seen it go into effect here again, essentially back in August. Both campaigns were allowed to ramp up transition teams to begin planning, and the rule in essence is those teams get to plan during the campaign, and whoever loses has 5 days to vacate the premises in a particular government building, and the other team gets more space and they get more money to sort of figure out how to get ready for day one.
And there's also some discretion, of course, from the White House. I mean, and some of it goes back. It's just a matter of wanting the incoming teams to have the right information. So one of the most dramatic moments that we can remember from the 2008 campaign was during the financial crisis at the very, very end of the campaign. And if you remember, there was that moment where President Bush invited then Senator Barack Obama and Senator John McCain to the White House, because he said, look, you guys are going to inherit this mess, one or the other of you, and you both need to have this information. And that was a remarkable moment for American democracy, I thought, because, you know, that's not written into any law that President Bush had to invite them there. That was presidential discretion, but it was really about ensuring that those candidates had that information. And you know, presidents don't we still have a president, and presidents don't get to choose when these crises come up. And making sure that the incoming team, or even back then, that both candidates have that information in real time is very important for being
able
to.
Well, as we're sitting down to this podcast, we're seeing a repeat of that, because President-elect Trump is going to the White House to meet with President
Obama.
Literally,
as we sit here.
And, you know, obviously this is a very passionate, hard-fought campaign, but I think, you know, part of it is, you know, trying to be very clear to act on the notion of the next president has been decided, now it's time to bring the country together. And that process of sort of the president-elect meeting the president is supplemented hundreds of times around Washington over the next several weeks, because members of the transition team for Donald Trump are going to be meeting with and trying to coordinate with the Obama transition team. Each agency essentially sets up a team whose responsibility is sort of prepare materials for the incoming administration, since the handoff. I mean, one of the interesting things in all of this, of course, has been some incoming administrations make great use of what the predecessors provided, and other incoming administrations want nothing to
do.
Clean
break.
There's a wonderful book written by Kurt Campbell and Jim Steinberg called Difficult Transitions. Both Kurt and Jim have been in a number of administrations, and in their book Difficult Transitions, they talk, for example, about the transition from Jimmy Carter to Ronald Reagan. And Jim Steinberg had worked in the Carter administration, spent a lot of time preparing all these briefing books to get the Reagan administration officials prepared. And the incoming Reagan team wanted nothing to do with it. And Jim in the book tells a story about his lasting memory is leaving his office with all of these big, thick briefing transition books that nobody ever read. So,
well, at least it developed into a book, though. Yep. So we have that.
I think it's worth noting also that, I mean, obviously the fact that the outcome of the election was that Trump won and Clinton did not is consequential in many, many, many ways. But for our particular purposes here, a significant difference would have been that Clinton would be taking over from a president of her party. And that, you know, even though she'd have the prerogative to appoint new people, and many of the people who were coming out probably are ready to come out and don't want to necessarily stay on forever, they would have been willing to serve as acting or stay on in some cases. And so it's just a bigger transition just in a process level, I think, than
yeah. When you change parties, yeah. You're more likely to get very substantial turnover at all of those staff positions,
and more likely to have people say, "I don't really need right. to know what you want to tell me. I want to do
but,
my
but
own."
Even, although it is, but I would just say for atmospherics, it's that. Back to Jim's original point, the respect for the process, I think, is an important thing for the country. I mean, yesterday there were a lot of people who were extremely down. There were others who were extremely pumped up by the results. And to have Secretary Clinton make her appearance in the morning and talk about, you know, the importance of the peaceful transfer of power, and then you had President Obama come out, and then setting up the meeting that's taking place as we're taping this podcast, all these things I think are part of. I think it gives people something to sort of hang their something
the
to rely on.
The machinery is really grinding on. I mean,
right.
without losing a step.
And I would add just one other thing, which is I think something we might hear more of. So we're also having a meeting of Vice President Biden and the Vice President-to-be Pence. That could be an extremely important meeting, as we're seeing in terms of the role Pence played in this campaign, but also the increasing authority or increasing amount of responsibilities vice presidents have been taking, whether it's in transition alone or transition and then follow on a big portfolio.
It used to be that the office of vice president was really an afterthought and very ceremonial. You attend funerals and so forth. And at least in recent years, Dick Cheney, Joe Biden, these have been critical members of their president's team, and really no longer ceremonial at all. To work in OVP has really got some cachet now. And it will be very interesting to see what role Mike Pence plays in the new administration.
Well, let's sort of talk about that, because we have obviously the vice president can play a significant role. Several of the recent vice presidents have had clear portfolios they've worked on. But let's talk about what we would call the team more broadly. We know that over the next several weeks, Certainly going into December, we're probably going to learn who the people are that President-elect Trump has picked to be on at his most senior positions and heading up cabinet agencies. But then you get into questions about when you're picking members of those teams, are you thinking about them as individuals or do you think about them as a team and how they're going to interact? And that just gets us to a broader question of, do we have a sense of how Donald Trump might approach assembling a government? I mean, he has a long career in business. Any sort of insight from that? Is it even applicable to the challenge he's facing right now?
So there's a lot to deal with there. I would say there are some features of this that are quite similar to recent administrations and some that are very different. And usually what you'd expect is that when a major party nominee wins the election, they draw from their major foreign policy team, probably domestic policy too, but this is, you know, we know foreign, that's what we're here to talk about, foreign policy, from the bench of their party, right? The foreign policy hands that are sort of affiliated with their party and a few that are sort of in the middle and can serve either side. But there's usually a pretty good bench. The issue here is that in the 2016 campaign, there was a very large percentage of foreign policy types on the Republican side who said they wouldn't work for Trump, the never Trumpers. And so, you know, without getting into the specifics of who, that just means the pool on the Republican side is a little smaller, even if some of them come back into the fold and so forth. I just think just in sheer numbers, the pool he can draw from is a little bit smaller. And so right away, that's a difference. And it's also the case that he's somewhat at odds on foreign policy on specific issues, which I know you'll get into in future weeks, so we don't have to talk about exactly which ones. But there are some pretty significant differences between his positions and those of the Republican foreign policy establishment.
You can name a few. I mean, trade, Russia,
those are kind of two of the biggest ones, right? The value of alliances. Those are sort of
The use of military force abroad.
And obviously, no party is totally unified on every issue. But he is unusually I would say the distinction between, you know, the candidate that they nominated and the foreign policy establishment in the party, that gap is bigger on it, I would say, than it normally is. That's, I think, a fair sort of statement. And so then think about what that means when you put whoever he picks, that team is going to come in, and it just makes it more likely. You can't say for sure, but it just makes the odds greater that there's going to be more divisions on specific policies. That potentially makes it more challenging to navigate to consensus. And so then it becomes a question of what kind of process is he going to set up? In terms of how business sort of expertise translates, the research that I know on expertise suggests that when people are really good at something, this goes back to studies of chess champions, where people who play chess and are, you know, experts, it doesn't actually translate that well from one domain to another. It's very what we call domain specific. Expertise.
And so this is like the Michael Jordan issue. He's all world in basketball, but not all world in baseball.
Yeah. It turns out, you know, batting 300 is great in baseball. So it's not clear that business acumen will translate. Doesn't mean Trump can't be good at it. It just means it's not obvious that expertise in one area is going to translate into another. And you know, whether you can run government like a business is still an open question. Well,
what about sort of the idea just in terms of how President Trump might approach his cabinet? Because we have a variety of different models for how presidents can run. We've often talked about having true cabinet-style government where the president empowers cabinet officials to go out and operate. They make decisions in the cabinet. That's been actually kind of rare in the American process. Indeed, I think many people argue that in recent years we've seen across Democratic and Republican administrations, power sort of being centralized in the White House because presidents want to, and technology increasingly allows them to have control over what they do. Do you have any sense of how Donald Trump might fall on that spectrum?
Only in terms of what we've seen emerge from the campaign trail as his campaign got stronger and stronger, and he emerged as the GOP candidate. I mean, there was a report that was much cited that his campaign had approached Governor Kasich to play a lead role in his campaign. And there's still some people who are thinking perhaps he'll set up almost a de facto prime ministership of someone who's running government in that fashion, and he's there to come in for the big decisions, but has a nuts and bolts person running things, you know, like a Governor Pence figure. We mentioned him earlier. So there's that possibility. The other thing I think it would be interesting to mention is this is all playing out. Staffs are being formed and contacts are being made. Meanwhile, the world is turning and will continue to turn for the next 10 weeks. What is the outgoing administration doing, and how much of what it's doing does it stay in touch with in the incoming administration? So President Obama is making a trip next week to Europe and then wrapping up with the APEC summit in South America. You know, is that something where there's some communications started with the incoming administration in any fashion, or really that's not necessary and it's just sort of finishing up some business?
Well, I'm sure there will be more communication. I mean, we also can't assume that what we read in the newspapers is the whole story, right? There's going to be a lot going on behind the scenes. I'm fascinated by this question of what will Obama do in the last couple months of his administration. And so I did what an academic does in these situations. I went to see who had written on this, and Phil Potter of the University of Virginia, it turns out, has just published a paper on lame duck foreign policy. What are the hallmarks of lame duck foreign policy when presidents are at the end of their terms? And he looked not just at the sort of general picture, but also kind of digging into like exactly what kinds of foreign policy actions the presidents are taking. And it turns out they travel more. There's an increase in diplomacy. They try to make more international agreements, and they're actually more prone to use force. Now, that, you know, at the moment we're already involved in Iraq and the Battle of Mosul, and all of that was sort of already underway. A major challenge for Obama, though, if he was to go and to try to strike a deal, like in the sort of last minute attempts that Bill Clinton made to have the to make peace in the Middle East, Trump has come in and said already that he wants to undo a lot of the initiatives that Obama has concluded. So with that sort of looming over him, it's not clear that Obama would really try to do something quite that dramatic. It wouldn't surprise me if he added a couple stops on his diplomatic itinerary to try to visit some more capitals. And you get into this question of, well, is he going to try to have a different message or reassure allies that Trump isn't going to make a major departure? But that, on some level, takes away from Trump's prerogatives a little bit. So the lame duck is sort of all about the outgoing president wanting to ensure his own legacy and entrench his policies and make it hard, you know, to tie the hands of the new administration on a few things. And when it's a different party and when the incoming president has said he's going to undo so many of the outgoing president's priorities, it's even more of a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, one example from that legacy, the set of legacy examples you mentioned, I recall, was when President Clinton, I think it was his final weeks in office, he signed on to the International Criminal Court. Mm-hmm. It was really seen as a gesture.
Yeah.
He knew the incoming administration was not keen on it. And sure enough, the Bush administration came in and unsigned the U.S. Involvement in the ICC.
And the use of force, you know, an example that comes to mind is the intervention in Somalia, which was undertaken by George H.W. Bush. After the election, knowing that the incoming Clinton team was in general more in favor of humanitarian intervention. Bush had resisted going into Somalia for a long time. And, you know, he made the decision to send a humanitarian mission. It was meant to be quite limited. He called up the president-elect and said, you know, home by Christmas, basically. Don't worry, won't be a mess left on your desk. And, of course, it was left on Bill Clinton's desk. And
yeah, well, lame duck diplomacy tends to get a bad rap from people in the other party because they don't like the fact that someone who's on the way out is making decisions that could constrain the person on the way in. But I think it's important to keep in mind that when we elect presidents, we elect them for 4 years. We don't elect them for more than 4 years, but we also don't elect them for less than four
exactly.
years. And while President Obama is in the final 2 months of his presidency, the fact is that he still exercises and is the only person who can exercise the powers of the President of the United States. And I think this is where you get into sort of matters of judgment and discretion about where sort of the sitting president, the lame duck president, has to make judgments about what he can actually do and how effective it will be. But I think there's also the flip side of the equation when you have to worry about the president-elect, the person coming in, potentially usurping the prerogatives of the person who holds the job. This is one of the dangers of having this sort of 70-plus day interregnum as you're sort of going from one to the other. Because again, obviously, if the sitting president is the person charged with speaking on behalf of the United States, but people are more interested in listening to what the guy who or someday woman who's going to be coming in has to say about these
issues. Kind of reminds me of Henry Kissinger's famous line about, like, if I want to call Europe, who do I call, right? Yeah. It's if I want to call the United States. Now, the answer, the correct answer is you call the guy who's still sitting in the White House, but you can, you know, you can understand or forgive the confusion that, you know, a foreign leader who hopes to get something good out of the new president might not want to treat the existing one.
Very much. And you can already see this. I mean, and this is true of every transition between parties I can think of, that people who are happy with the incoming president, with the president-elect, can be quite vocal about the fact that they're only going to be paying attention to the person coming over the horizon, not the person currently in the Oval Office. And I think for the most part, American presidents and president-elects have handled that delicate dance fairly well. And I think it's a credit to sort of the norms about the office, about the transition and what have you, which we've alluded to, I think, implicitly at least earlier in the podcast, are sort of very firmly held. But again, you run into a difficulty in which an event breaks, a crisis occurs in which the person in charge, the incumbent president, has a very different vision of how one should respond to it than the person coming into office. Those instances have been fairly uncommon, but there's always a potential that could lead for some significant bitterness. Because obviously, if you are the incoming president, you don't want to have somebody you disagree with constraining your freedom of maneuver.
Yeah, and I think also back to something Elizabeth said about the sort of the how you're prosecuting ongoing hot wars or at least conflict zones. That is a particularly interesting area because I think it's incoming presidents, I think, have traditionally been loath to immediately pull the plug on any military operation. But also there's a danger of getting further entangled or maybe not having to learn all over again why the U.S. may be involved in a certain place. And I think the Somalia example is a very interesting one to follow. The incoming Trump administration is going to have to look closely at what's going on in both Syria and Iraq and this sort of coordination of the Raqqa and the Mosul initiatives and the really complex stew of allies and other things going on there and come in with a sense of what what is going to be the U.S. play there. And it's got a lot of people relying on U.S. leadership and firepower and putting their lives on the line, in some cases, a lot of the allies on the front lines. And, again, delicate balance with other U.S. allies, nation-state allies like Turkey and Iraq and so forth. So that's going to be especially interesting to watch.
I think you're quite right, and I think it brings up a host of issues related to presidential power, to transition, and to sort of process and staffing and policy, right, and the stew of that and exactly how much presidents can do on their own. I think about the transition of George W. Bush, who came in. If you go back and you read the transcript of the debates, the 2000 debates, he is very, very, very clear that he is opposed to nation building. One of the clearest things he said on foreign policy and throughout all three of those debates. And he comes in and he appoints people who are opposed to nation building. And that becomes the policy. He rescinds a PDD, the President Clinton Presidential Decision Directive that President Clinton had issued on nation building.
And he was going to focus on this hemisphere.
He was going to focus on this hemisphere and build up military strength, but he was not going to go around rebuilding other countries, right? Presidents don't get to choose what crises are thrown at them, right? And 9/11 happens, and then, you know, without relitigating all of it, you know, we end up in the Iraq War, and then the problem of nation building confronts him head on, and he became, you know, a nation builder. And the issue there is, you know, it highlights a few things. One, that presidents come into office with a set of beliefs and they tend not to change, and their priorities are to get those beliefs reflected in, appoint the right people and get the, you know, issue policies that will get that reflected in their bureaucracy, which is kind of like a big hulking ship that's hard to turn on a dime. But then they're constrained by the flow of events, and sometimes they are forced to change direction. But again, it's hard to
turn
that ship.
And that's that question of personnel that we were talking about as well, is you bring in people who are adept at nation building if that's what you want to focus on.
Yeah, but then it's hard to get them in there. You can't just – it's not like, you know, 10 Downing Street. Like, it's very hard to just call up a bunch of people and say, okay, today I decided I want to do nation building. Come work for me, right? It's just hard to do
that. But it's different, for example, in a parliamentary system. Think of the British system, because when you have change in government, it's actually a very small number of people who rotate out. Your permanent civil service – stays there. And again, the American system, you go many levels down into the bureaucracy, are political appointees who serve at the pleasure of the president and rotate out when a new president comes in. And I think, you know, one of the lessons of presidential transitions, or maybe more correctly, early months of a presidential administration, is that you find out very quickly how well you have chosen and how well you have staffed your administration, because events happen and you have to respond. And sometimes you respond well, sometimes you don't respond well. I mean, the classic example would be John Kennedy allowing the planning for the Bay of Pigs to proceed, and then we had the Bay of Pigs, and it was a fiasco. And Kennedy came away with some very strong conclusions about the mistakes that he had made, about how he had staffed his administration, who he had listened to, who he had allowed to participate.
It colored his view of the CIA for the rest of his presidency.
And it, I think it also came back in some sense, it had a fruitful benefit because it shaped how he responded a year and a half later to the Cuban Missile Crisis.
I think that Absolutely. And his initial contact with the Soviet leader, where he was seen as he was kind of schooled, and then he came back, again, wiser from that experience.
And that really, again, highlights that that's a great example. And the Cuban Missile Crisis highlights a sort of unique feature of the Kennedy administration, which is that he had an advisor that he trusted implicitly because it was his brother. And one thing we haven't talked about is that they're often, you know, we're talking about the professionals, even the cabinet folks are typically professionals. There's also the president's family, and Donald Trump is really – one of the things we do know about Donald Trump is that he relies very heavily on the advice of his family. And that's not – I mean, he may do it to a greater degree, but most presidents have someone close to them that they rely on. Kennedy is one of the most dramatic examples because he put his brother in cabinet, and RFK was really instrumental in the XCOM meetings.
Right. But that's the old rule that the person who has the title – is not necessarily the person who has the president's ear.
Yeah.
And I think that's always important to keep in mind. And that's true across administrations,
Absolutely.
Democrat, Republican. Presidents appoint people, but they also get to decide who they want to listen to on which issues. And it's only sort of looking in the rearview mirror that we really have a good sense of who it is that any president is going to be listened to over the course of their administration.
It's worth noting that the world is not waiting to see to try to get in touch with Mr. Trump. They're eager that this is the person they're going to be dealing with, even though there will be meetings with the lame duck administration for the next couple of months. And there's been a number of messages directed to President-elect Trump, either via Twitter or telegrams. I think the Russian President Putin actually sent him a formal telegram congratulating him. He's had contacts from an array of world leaders. He's actually going to – it looks like he's going to have his first meeting with the head of state in New York next week. The Japanese Prime Minister, head of government, excuse me, Prime Minister Abe. So that should be interesting. There's a great deal of interest in who's ever sitting in the White House to do business and to get to know and take and try to take the measure of that person.
Well, that's because leaders of other countries live in a world in which the United States matters. And however they may have felt about who they wanted to win the election, they now know who is won. It is Mr. Trump. They are going to work with him because they have to work with him. And this is standard. And I would note that this is perfectly acceptable for people to reach out to the president-elect. It has happened with every new incoming president I can think of, and it will continue. Where you start to get disputes is when does it edge from acknowledging, congratulating, wishing best wishes, want to work with you, to actually starting to do business before you've taken the oath of office. And that sort of gray area lies in the eye of the beholder, what some people find to be perfectly reasonable and acceptable, others find outrageous and unacceptable. And there's always a potential over the next several weeks we'll have controversies about that, but they generally tend to fade away.
I think that's right. And I think one thing that this period is also about is building relationships. And we know from research on diplomacy that a lot of diplomacy is sort of about – it's not this splashy deal making, right? It's about, you know, getting to know you and seeing you again, you know, same time next year, like just tending to these relationships.
George H.W. Bush was the sort of the champion of that.
Absolutely. And
cultivated and world leaders.
And would talk to anybody, yep. Adversary. You know, Jim Baker was constantly saying yep. – even criticized, you know, George W. Bush, or maybe it was John McCain in the 2008 election, you know, came to the defense of Obama as a candidate when he said, you know, I want to sit down with the Iranians. Like he said, yeah. You just sit down with anybody who will sit down with you, right? So this is about relationship building, because when the crises come, you call your allies, right? And you need to know who to call, and it's very helpful. And I think, you know, again, there are so many contrasts between Clinton and Trump. And one of them, just by virtue of the fact that she had served as Secretary of State, she had relationships with a lot of these countries and the people who run them, right? Not just the top leaders, the foreign ministers and so forth. Trump, for better or for worse, doesn't have a lot of those personal relationships. And so he's got more ground now, certainly no more ground than, say, Mitt Romney would have had in 2012. But that's just a, you know, a basic fact that he's starting from a lot lower baseline of knowing these world leaders and getting to know them, with a couple of exceptions.
Well, that takes us back to where we sort of began this conversation, which is the first order of business is to assemble the team. Who is going to be on that team? How well do they know the areas that they're going to be responsible for? What kind of networks do they have? And how does all of that fit together? It is an incredibly daunting task, and I wish Mr. Trump that he chooses well and wisely.
I think we're all rooting for a smooth transition.
And on that note, thanks for joining us for our inaugural episode of The President's Inbox, Elizabeth.
Thank you. It's a pleasure and an honor.
Next week, we start getting into the individual issues, and a priority for President-elect Trump is trade.
My prediction is that trade policy is going to be one of the major initiatives that President Trump rolls out in the first days and weeks of his administration.
So this will be very interesting to watch, because U.S. Trade Representative is not usually one of the highest profile appointments that an incoming president makes, but it might well be this year.
Be sure to subscribe to The President's Inbox on iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps. Please note that opinions expressed in The President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, thanks for coming, Elizabeth, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by the incomparable Kevin Lizarazo, with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock and recording engineer John Fletcher. Special thanks to Audrey Bowler, Bardia Viseggi, and Jonathan Levitt. This is Jim Lindsay.
And this is Robert McMahon. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on The President's Inbox.